All right, we are in Building 42, doing a deep, basically taking the razor to razor.
Right.
Who are you? What's your name?
I'm Andrew Nurse. I'm a SD on the ASP.NET team. I've worked on the razor parser basically from start to finish of the final implementation. Sort of actually just, I got here to Microsoft about 9 months ago. And they sort of said, this is what we're thinking about for a new syntax. They had some prototypes, some ideas, and basically said, now it's your job to go build it. So
excellent, man.
So we did that. We, you know, worked as a team, a lot of group design stuff, but yeah, basically.
So let me ask you a question. I mean, this is sort of tangential, which is fine because it's Channel 9. We like to focus, you know, on the humans as well as the technology. And we're going to, like I said, we'll take a razor to this and understand what you've done. 9 months at Microsoft, you're starting to fulfill, you know, sort of what I've been watching over the years on Channel 9 is that a lot of people in DevDiv are super young. Now I feel old with my gray hair, man. But what's your story? So you studied CS. Why did you decide to work at Microsoft?
Yeah, I grew up in Vancouver, Canada.
Oh.
I always loved computers. My dad loved computers, too. He's been in the industry, and he sort of brought a computer into the house and, like, we tinkered a bit together in programming, and I just also went off on my own and, like, just read up on stuff. I remember reading up on QBasic and messing around in QBasic, a little tinkering in Visual Basic, and then through high school I didn't do much programming, but then I knew as soon as I graduated from high school that I wanted to go into CS. It was basically meant to be. I figured that out pretty early. So, yeah, I went to Simon Fraser University in BC, and I got a CS degree, and in my third year, my fourth year, I went to a Microsoft booth at a career fair, and I said, I'm interested. I gave him my resume. I'd always used Microsoft technologies, Microsoft products, so I'd always wanted to try it out. I did an internship on the Visual Studio team, working on the DataDude product. And then I'd always had a passion for the web. I knew I used ASP.NET a lot, so coming back for another internship, I was like, I told my recruiter, I really want to get on ASP.NET if I can. So I did, and I ended up on this team, working on the MVC team, writing some of the Ajax helpers that came out. And then they basically gave me the offer full-time, and I came back after I graduated.
Cool, man. Well, congratulations. I mean,
thanks.
You just shipped a Web Matrix or Razor.
Yeah. Well, Web Matrix and Razor is part of Web Matrix,
Got it. This is, you know, Razor is the parser, the view engine.
Yeah. I mean, Razor at its core is just a templating engine.
Okay.
I mean, we're using it in a web context, and we're using it in Web Matrix in this inline page sort of scripting model where you can just, you request a page and we just run that code. So you put all your code in there to be really easy to get up and running really, really fast. And we're also looking at it in the context of an MVC view engine as well. So that'll fit into the MVC model.
Interesting.
But at its core, it's just a templating engine.
Okay.
So, I mean, we're actually looking at doing some work to separate out, really, really separate out those dependencies and just say, you know, we've got Razor, which is just the syntax for templating, and then we've got places we're using it in ASP.NET, but you can use it in a console app, you can use it wherever you want.
Interesting. So let's dive right into this. I mean, you already answered the question of what is Razor. And what we want to do in today's sort of exercise or conversation is really understand how it works exactly.
Right.
I mean, you wrote it.
Yeah.
So let's talk about what the parser does, how it determines where it begins executing, where it knows where HTML is, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Those are in line with some of the questions Niners had. So let's dig in, man.
All right. Okay. Well, I've got some example up on the whiteboard. I'll go through that in a sec. But I think it's probably good to start with sort of contrasting the model of Razor versus ASPX, the traditional syntax.
Okay.
And the way I've drawn it up is, if you look at an ASPX document, you've sort of got these two streams, code and markup, right?
Yep.
And so when you have that angle bracket percent, you've got a chunk of code, right? And then you close it and you do a chunk of markup. And then you open a new one and you do the chunk of code and you do a chunk of markup. You're always bouncing back and forth, right?
Yep.
You're not really, you're in one or the other, you're never sort of in both. Razor is a bit more like a tree structure. So the outer context is, you know, you've got an HTML document. And then inside there, you put code blocks. Right?
Yep.
But then inside those code blocks, you put further markup blocks. And then you could have a markup block and another code block within that. And so you're basically nesting these contexts to get one inside the other. Whereas in ASPX, you've got two parallel streams. You're just sort of jumping into one and jumping into the other. In Razor, you're jumping back and forth between them in sort of a tree kind of structure. So that's sort of how the philosophy of how we sort of, I entered the parsing ideas and how we, when we were designing it. And as far as the actual design, we sort of looked at taking just a simple example of like, I want to iterate over a collection, so for each var p in, you know, foo, some collection, and then I want to render out an li that contains some value from that collection. And we said, that's what the user wants.
Mm-hmm.
But a parser can't really unambiguously decide what's code and what's markup here. So let's insert just what we need to figure out that difference. And we figured out that basically you just need to put an at sign in front of each of these things. So those are the sort of underlying philosophies of Razor. So
okay.
We can actually go through a document I've sort of written up on my whiteboard here and actually sort of see how it actually works. So when the Razor parser encounters this document, it starts off... Razor is built in with basically one main sort of coordinating parser, like an orchestrator.
Okay.
So you've got the Razor parser, and it's got two sort of sub-parsers. And I hesitate to use the word parser because that implies that they understand a lot about these languages, but it's got a C-sharp and HTML comprehender is the word I've sort of been talking about. Because it doesn't, like, for example, the C-sharp parser doesn't know what variables are in scope. It doesn't know what classes you can call. It doesn't know all of that stuff. But it has an idea of the syntax. It knows that a statement ends with a semicolon, an if block has open curly brace and closed curly brace. It knows enough to be able to find out the boundaries.
Okay.
Similarly, the HTML parser doesn't know which tags can go in which other tags. It just knows that it's generally XML-like. We have a little bit of some, you know, smarts in our parser to detect where you're not quite doing XHTML. But it doesn't actually totally, fully understand the HTML. So when the parser starts off, this sort of main coordinator says, right at this first character, I'm parsing a document of markup. So it's going to read through until it finds the end of the file or an at sign. So it sees this first at sign.
Okay.
That's when it's in the HTML parser, parsing that document, then it sees an at sign. The HTML parser says, at sign means switch to code. So it calls into the code parser, which in this case is C-sharp, but we have a VB one as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, parse me one block of C-sharp. And when you're finished, I'll go back to parsing markup. All right? So the C-sharp parser then sits here and says, okay, curly brace, that means to parse from here until the end, closing curly brace. So it does that. It scans through. And now we're just reading C-sharp. It's also going to look for markup, but there is no markup in this case. I'll sort of go into that when we get further down. And so it finishes its block, and it returns. So it's sort of, it's a recursive structure. We've got a call stack of markup parser, code parser, and then the code parser finishes. It goes back to the markup parser.
Mm-hmm.
It keeps going along, and it finds the next at block. And it says again to the code parser, parse me one block of C-sharp code. This time, it looks at that first keyword and sees that it's an if. So this is where we have some special logic in our parser where we recognize these C-sharp keywords, like if, for each, do, while, those kind of keywords. So it knows that an if statement is followed by something in parentheses. And again, this is where we're not really a parser, because it doesn't actually care what's in these parentheses. It just reads it through, balancing parentheses to make sure they're all matched up. And then it knows that after this curly brace, there's a block of code.
Okay.
So this is where we're now getting into the nesting. So if we sort of draw that tree structure sort of over top, in Razor, this entire block is a code block. Right? So then, basically, after this open curly brace, the code parser sees this UL tag. And it's smart enough, it's sort of keeping an eye on where it is in a C-sharp statement, and it knows that after this curly brace, it's right at the start of a C-sharp statement. And you can't just put a less than sign right at the start of a C-sharp statement. It's not valid C-sharp. So it could only be markup in this case. So we make the assumption that it's markup.
Okay.
And so now basically we've got our call stack. I'll draw the call stack up here. We got markup when we were up here, and then we entered this code block, so we went into code. And now we're in the middle of code, and we see markup, so we sort of recursively go back into the markup parser. And the markup parser, the code parser asks the markup parser, parse me one block of markup.
Okay.
So in this case, the markup parser says, got a UL tag. So one block, in that terms, is from the start UL to the end UL, and then it's done. And then it'll go back to code, see this curly brace, and the code block will say, well, now I'm done, and it'll return back up, and we'll get back to the top again. So what you end up happening is this UL becomes one of those nested markup blocks within it.
Okay.
And so on and so on. So here we see the at sign, so now it's going to, the markup parser sees the at sign and knows that's going back to code, so we add another level to our call stack, we go into the code parser, parses that for each, goes into the for each, sees this li, and we sort of keep building this tree going down, right?
Yep.
And that's sort of how we're able to disambiguate whether this closed curly brace is something the user meant to render, or is it actually the end of the for each.
Mm.
It's because we know when we finished this li, we're not in markup anymore.
Sure.
We're back in code. So if you wanted to, you could put more tags after this li, but they would all have to have an end, and then we would go back to code.
Sure.
So it's basically, that leads to sort of one of the little limitations of Razor, which is that inside this block, you do have to have that outer tag closed, right? A lot of times when you're writing an li, you know, you might not put that there, right?
But you should if you're
writing
compliant.
You should if you're writing XHTML compliant file, which is one of the reasons we're sort of, our guidance is, if you write XHTML, you'll be fine.
Sure.
If you write HTML without XML, you'll get some places where it'll work, and you might get some places where things will be a little weird.
But then again, you could do it. You could have the HTML parser understand or not run in strict mode, if you will, and it will know that, well, LIs are things that sometimes aren't going to have to be closed.
Yeah, I mean,
like
our
a certain mapping.
Yeah, our parser doesn't really do that, because one of the issues is, if let's say we did that, right? We know the li doesn't have to be closed.
Yeah.
But then the question is this code or markup? Like, I mean, as a human looking at it, yeah, I mean, we know it's code, but
yeah,
the machine, you know, the parser running through it is like, it could be, you could have a li later on, and we could scan down and see, oh, there's no li in backtrack, but
mm-hmm,
we can't really, at this point, we can't unambiguously determine what the intent is. So we require that you put that li tag here, the close li tag here. And that way we know, okay, you finished markup, so now we're back to interpreting things as code. And that's
so let me ask you a question then.
Yeah.
So in the old school way of doing it, which was just essentially, you know, open brace, percent, either
right,
equal sign for response.write, or just no equal sign, meaning execute code inside of this block.
Right.
In that case, you wouldn't really need to put an li, because you could just have the close percent.
Yeah, I mean, in that case, you'd have your bound. In that case, the rigidity is around the code here, right? It's you've got the opening and the closing thing here, and then you have to open code again to write this curly brace. So we know for sure that that's code.
Mm-hmm.
But in Razor, we're trying to make things flow together a little better, and we're seeing the industry move towards XHTML being a really big thing.
Yeah.
So we figured people are already moving a lot to this kind of format, so we can take advantage of that to smooth out the syntax of it.
Now, what about, like I had mentioned with the, I mean, the last time I wrote in ASP.NET, it was all about response.write.
Right.
Right. You know, being able to sort of disambiguate or distinguish between, I actually just want the server to write this out versus compute.
Ah, yes.
In this case, you just have the at.
Yeah.
Sort of your global identifier.
That's a great sort of segue into the next part of Razor. I'm going to wipe this stuff out now, and we'll go to some more simple samples here. What most people probably noticed is there is no at equals.
Yeah.
There's nothing that disambiguates between rendering
mm-hmm.
and executing, right? So the way we do that is basically what follows the at sign. So if you go at for each, was going to, you know. If you write at for each, we take this first identifier and we look it up in a table we have. And we say, is this a C-sharp keyword? And in this case, yes, it is. Mm-hmm. Okay, then what? This is a statement block then. So this is basically equivalent to angle bracket percent, right?
Yep.
Now, what if it's P, right? P is not a C-sharp keyword. So we read that identifier. We say, not a C-sharp keyword. Okay, so then that's equivalent to angle bracket percent colon, which is basically angle bracket percent equals, but in .NET 4 we added this syntax which automatically HTML encodes. That's one thing. All Razor views, all of the every time you output a variable, it's automatically HTML encoded, unless you return IHTML string. So it's basically, it's the same as this angle bracket percent colon, which is sort of the way we wanted to move things to get more automatic HTML encoding.
Cool.
So then we have a couple other sort of plan 9 constructs. You know, what if you want to output P++, right? Mm-hmm. Well, we don't want to know, we could say, well, do you want to output P and then the markup plus plus? Or do you want to output P, the value of incrementing P? It's a little hard for us to disambiguate that, so if you want to do something more complex, you go at parentheses. And that is also equivalent to angle, so that is exactly equivalent to angle bracket percent colon P plus plus, right? These two syntaxes are, behave exactly the same. What's sort of magic about this syntax is we let you sort of do a little bit of more complicated expressions here. It doesn't have to be just a single identifier. You could go dot name or something. You could access a property. You can call a method. That's allowed too. You can access array values. That's allowed too. But generics, for example, we get to really confusing things where, you know, is this markup or is this a generic type argument? So if you want to do this, that's when you wrap the parens around it to make sure to make it
very
clear. We took a little bit of a cue from PowerShell too. And basically, in PowerShell, you can go quote in the middle of a string. You can just go dollar foo, and it'll expand out the value of that value variable. It's like a string.format built right in. But if you put something that's not valid in an identifier, like an exclamation mark, it's able to know that's all you want to render. So if you went at p exclamation mark, that'll render the value of p followed by an exclamation mark. If you put at p with a dot, with no identifier after it, the parser is smart enough to say that p dot nothing is not valid code.
Sure.
So it'll just output this p and put a period afterwards as markup. So we do a little bit of magic to try and make the most common scenarios for, I just want to take this loop variable or this thing that I've got from the database and just print a property of it. I mean, if you look at most angle bracket percent equals in like MVC, Vue Engine code, I would bet most of it is just accessing properties,
sure.
Right? And so the idea here, and maybe dictionary items like your Vue data, things like that. So that's why we optimize to make this case work for that. But if you want to do anything more complex, then you use the parentheses to make it really clear.
And also, I mean, you know, let's be honest. I mean, this is in some sense C-sharp scripting, right? I mean,
in some ways, yeah.
In some way, I mean, you're not going to use this kind of syntax to create classes and
right.
Implement interfaces. Let me ask you a question about the at symbol, though. This is the first thing I thought of when I first learned about this. In C-sharp, obviously, at will mean escape the string.
Right.
Don't worry about escaping the string. How do you deal with
that? Yeah, so let's go back a little bit to sort of the... First off, at isn't really much of a control character for Razor in code.
Okay.
It's used to go from markup to code,
all right,
for the most part.
Right.
There's a couple cases in the inline templating stuff that we've talked a little about, but that gets into a little more complex scenarios. So, for example, we've got an if block or something here. We've got a grid helper, right? You could write a grid, I think it's called getHTML, and eventually, somewhere in this grid helper call, you can pass in a chunk of markup representing what you want this column to look like, for example, as a template, mm-hmm. right? And that uses the at sign. And then you can put a tag, right?
Yeah.
The issue here is exactly what you said. At has meaning in C#. We can't just assume whenever we see an at that it is it's this, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we basically, our parser is smart enough to know this is where it gets into this C-sharp comprehension. It knows that C-sharp allows a string to start with an at sign. It knows that you can go at class as an identifier, for example, and to escape the fact that class is a keyword. So it looks for these kind of cases here. And basically, the C-sharp parser is saying, is it at followed by a tag? If it is, then that's for me. If it's not, then it's for C-sharp to handle. So let C-sharp do it, do what it wants to do. There's a couple other cases where, you know, there's sort of ambiguities. Once you go at if in here, this line is actually code. So you could go var, you could start keep typing code, right? You could keep going with code. It hasn't gone to markup yet. You could put another if statement in, right? You could go if foo less than bar. Well, that looks a lot like markup. Right, and our parser's not really trying to be too smart about how it detects markup.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than get confused with this kind of thing, what we do is we say that, and then again, this is more of the C-sharp comprehension, we sort of track C-sharp statements. Right, we're not parsing it, but we're tracking the statements. So when we get here, we look at this first keyword. It's var. And var is just a statement that ends in a semicolon. So we basically just scan forward to find that semicolon, and we say, that's all C-sharp. Then we go to the next thing, if. We know if is a statement that starts with a curly brace, ends with a closed curly brace, so we scan this. We know all this is code, and then we start scanning the body of the if statement. So we're tracking where in a C-sharp statement we are. So you can't just put, like, if you did write something like this in the middle of an if statement, we know we're in the middle of an if statement, so it's not a place where you can put markup. So we just disregard it. It goes straight into C-sharp. And that's not valid C-sharp, but the C-sharp compiler will throw an error there. But because when you're like here, right after that semicolon, we know that you're at the start of a C-sharp statement, so you can put markup here.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so when we see that less than sign, then we know that isn't a less than sign, it's open angle bracket for the li tag.
Cool. And of course, I mean, I could see a really good use for link, you know, in line.
Yeah.
And of course, obviously, you can do that. There's going to be certain things that you can't do, though.
Yes.
Right? So, but I mean, optional parameters will work in this context.
I mean, for the most part, once you get into code, you are in code. It's just, there's these little gotchas, like when you want to put markup inside.
Sure. Well, I mean, you have to hope that people understand that are using these technologies the difference between code and markup.
Yeah.
But kind of the cool thing, I mean, about the old way of doing it was that the doorway into code was essentially the same as the doorway into markup because it really was that open brace.
Right.
And you had the weird percent equals, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But this is actually a little bit more elegant and simple, which is nice.
Yeah. And one of the things about the syntax versus ASPX that we noticed is, you know, with ASPX, you've got those big bumblebees, as someone on the team has called them,
that
are saying, you know, open bumblebee, close bumblebee, the little angle bracket percent
things. Yeah.
It's really clear when you're in code. And here, it's fairly clear when you're in code, but there's those little tiny edge cases that you want to try and figure out. And that's why, if you've looked at some of the screenshots in Scott Goo's blogs of WebMatrix, the code is highlighted in a different background color. So we're making Razor as Notepad-friendly as possible, but we're also trying to provide good tooling like WebMatrix, and there's going to be Visual Studio integration as well.
Mm.
And what we're doing in that is making it really clear through the background coloring and the various syntax coloring elements that what's code and what's markup. So that if you do ever get into those cases where you're looking at this code that's rendering and you're saying, I don't quite get why this is markup and not code, it should be really clear in the editor. We're also making sure that, for the most part, Razor doesn't have these weird ambiguities. It's very clear in the 90% case what's markup and what's code. But there are those edge cases, and we want to try and handle those with some of the editor tools.
Cool. So now let's dig in a little deeper here in terms of, I mean, I'm going to go out on a limb and say you probably wrote your parser in C-sharp.
Yep.
Why didn't you use F-sharp?
In many ways...
it's not really an important question.
Yeah, I mean, I actually looked into F-sharp when I was working on it.
Mm-hmm.
it was sort of just one of the things. We did it in C# because we know C#. Sure. F# is a great language for parsers, and it would be an interesting exercise to see how much simpler the parser would be in F# because the C# parser is not... I mean, it's hard to write a grammar for this kind of parser because you effectively have to embed the C# and HTML grammars in your Razor grammar because you have to define how the code flows, right?
Sure.
So the Razor parser itself is mostly a handwritten parser.
Okay.
So F# might be a good way to sort of make it a little more elegant, make it a little cleaner. There are, you know, a lot number of issues. F#'s got some runtime elements, which are part of the framework now, but we wanted to try and make this... Like, the Razor parser itself is dependent on system.dll and mscorelib.dll, and that's it. So we wanted to try and cut that back. Not many of the team are that familiar with F#, so we wanted to make the code as readable as possible.
No worries. I mean, I asked, I asked the C# team why they're not writing their compiler in F#.
Yeah.
And they have basically the same answer. That might be a good exercise to do. Yeah. I only say that because the F# is a language that offers a kind of profound amount of flexibility in a kind of a very simplified way.
Yeah, I know F# is really good for writing parsers.
Sure.
And I'm trying to sort of get some time together to, like...
Right on, but that's really not that important.
Yeah.
Let's get to some things that are important, and these are questions from Niners.
All right.
And, of course, Dan had said he wants to learn more about how you built your parser, which you've talked about. And he also wants to know about the colorizer, which you just mentioned.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about that.
Okay, so the colorizer in WebMatrix is actually really, really simple. It basically runs our parser, and then it takes the parse tree that we spit out. We basically build out a parse tree that says, that is a transition, that is code, that is code, that is markup, and so on and so on. Mm. So it basically is just able to map those to regions in its editor, and they're using their editor components have ways of mapping that. In fact, when we were prototyping this, we didn't have an editor, and it was really nice to have that syntax coloring. So what we did is we actually used the extensibility points in Visual Studio 2010, using the classifiers that you can build using MEF.
Nice.
And we basically, over a weekend, hacked together a colorizer for this parser that basically... It wasn't very efficient. I mean, every time you typed a character, it reparsed the whole document. And that's where the editors, like in WebMatrix and in Visual Studio Integration, they're going to improve upon that. But we had something that, for short documents, made it really nice and clear. And the parser itself, even in the current beta, is all publicly accessible. So it's open to developing editors using our own parser.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Now, the other question we have here is, what happens, and you kind of already addressed this, but I kind of want to read off. So we asked Dan's one of Dan's questions, and now we're moving on to Barry, one of his questions. What happens with legal HTML, which isn't legal XML? And we kind of touched on that.
Yeah, I can go into a touch more detail on that.
Cool.
Basically, the only case where we actually care about whether it's legal XML is inside that code block. So out here, you can put whatever you want. You can drop tags, not have closed tags, whatever you want, when you're outside of code completely. When you're inside code, we care about the first tag and the ending tag.
Yep.
So if you want, you could put a B tag here, put some text, and not close it. That's okay, because what we do is when we enter here, as I said, the marker parser is saying, parse a block. And so it just uses a stack, basically. It says, all right, I see an open P tag, so put a P on the stack. And I see an open B tag, so put B on the stack. Mm-hmm. Then I see close P. Well, that doesn't match what's on the top of the stack, so just get rid of that. Mm-hmm. It matches this guy, so get rid of that. And now we're done, right?
Okay.
So it's really just this outer tag. Whatever you put on the outside, if you put any more in here, like another P, you have to close it. But every other tag doesn't really matter. But because of that rule, it takes just a little bit extra explaining. If you use XHTML everywhere, you're good. Mm-hmm. You're going to be fine. But if you don't, if you really want to keep it, if you've got legacy apps, you want to keep the HTML as it is, you've got other reasons for keeping it as it is, it's these outer tags that really have to be balanced. And if you really want to put an outer tag that you can balance without actually rendering it, we have a pseudo tag you can put. If you could put the text tag... This tag is not actually rendered out, the text tag. It's a special tag in Plan 9 that just says, use this tag to delimit the boundaries, but don't actually render it. So the output from this will just be this section.
Right.
So in this case, you could then put like an li that isn't closed inside the text tag, because then the li isn't part of that decision of when code, when markup ends. Mm-hmm. The text tag is the one that's doing that.
Would it be useful to have some sort of, you know, parser instructions where, say, you could use some sort of attribute to say, hey, XHTML going forward, but then you guys don't have to do the rocket science to figure out, okay, this is closed, this is inside here. Just go, okay, everything has to be closed.
Right.
And have another one that just says HTML compliant. Because XHTML pretty much is a failure as far as adoption worldwide, right, amongst the developer community.
Yeah.
It's a great idea, though, but I don't see it as being a tremendous success.
Yeah.
Which is what Barry is sort of getting at here about, it's legal HTML, but it's not XML.
Yeah, and I mean, we talked about a number of things, like when our testers were working on testing out this syntax,
sure.
They're like, I want to put an HR tag in, and I have to close it, right? Things like HR and BR are things we could probably solve pretty easily, because they're empty. They don't contain any contents. So we would know, we would be able to look, we'd be able to have lists in our parser and say, okay, HR, we can special case that.
Sure.
If we don't see a closed tag, whatever, it's just empty. The issues are really with things like LI, because LI does have content, right?
Yes.
And so the question in our parser is, you know, foo, maybe I have something on another line. This is all part of the LI as far as HTML is concerned, until you see the next tag, right? And it becomes difficult. So let's say you then put your close UL because it's outside of this.
Mm-hmm.
This curly brace would get lumped in with the rest of the body of the LI. It'd be hard for us to tell, where does this LI end? Does it end here? Does it end here? Does it end here? Where does it end, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the biggest case where it becomes difficult. The tags that can be unclosed but have content.
Sure.
And as I said, it's really just in here you need to be XHTML compliant.
And that's good. That's fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you already mentioned there are workarounds by using the text.
Yeah, you can use the text tag. The other thing we've got is you can go at, instead of putting a tag, you can put at colon. And what that says is markup until the end of the line. So that doesn't even care about tags. It just reads to the end of the line. And all of that is treated as markup. You could put a closed curly brace in there. Mm-hmm. You could put code anywhere in here. It's all treated as markup.
Okay.
So that's useful in a couple cases that have come up in some of the people commenting on various blogs. How do I do this?
Mm-hmm.
If I want to go if some condition, wrap this in a div, you know, and then some text here, and then you go again, you go if that condition was true, I need to close that div, right?
Yep.
So the issue here is that this open div and this closed div means that this whole block will be treated as markup. Because we see the open div, we're in markup until we see the closed div. So all of this stuff gets ignored, gets treated as markup, and so we lose that sort of way to figure out when the code ends. So the solution to that is you can go at colon, which is, as I said, it means this is markup until the end of the line. Don't worry about tags at all. Just at the end of the line, stop. Right?
Okay.
So that's how you can do things like this. So there's little escape hatches for when our implicit logic doesn't quite cut it.
Mm.
And I mean, if you look at this, it's still more concise than the ASPX syntax. So yeah, you could argue that this is almost like ASPX at this point. You're having to be very explicit about all the transitions. But it's sort of a 20% case, not an 80% case. And it's that little escape hatch there for when our implicit logic can't quite make it.
Excellent. All right, let's move on with another Niner question.
All right.
And of course, this is going to come up anytime you release a new technology that involves computation, just like a parser, you're matching things, you're computing. Somebody said, this is from, I believe, Zippy V. If not Zippy V, it's from Min. I'm sorry, guys, I didn't write your names out. I know it's one of you two. Somebody said that Razor is slower because it's more complicated than ASP.NET's. Open, percent sign, blah, 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 stuff. But Razor seems to be more simple. So basically the question is, are you doing more computations up front than you were in the old days?
Right. So, I mean, Razor is a much more complicated syntax than ASPX. ASPX can basically be parsed with regular expressions.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, the Razor parser is slower than the ASPX parser.
Okay.
It's sort of a fact of the nature of the language.
Mm-hmm.
How much slower? We've done some initial perf testing, and it's very minor, the perf testing. And we've done almost no optimization to the code, and there's a lot of places we're going to go in and tune up that code. And the other thing is, because of the ASP.NET model of compilation,
mm-hmm.
it's only that first hit that's going to see any performance hit anyway.
Yep.
So even if Razor is a couple percent slow, which is about what we're slower, which is about what we're seeing, that's the couple percent on your first hit, and every other hit is a standard, you know, loading up a DLL, running a method. It's
awesome.
Almost nothing, yeah.
And of course, so you know, Sven Group, our brilliant Dutchman who's been on Channel 9 for a long time, of course, that was his answer. He likes to answer questions at his fellow Niners. So good job, Sven.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's see. When I was looking at the Razor code in Scott Gu's post, suddenly I remembered Lucian Wyszczyk, the guy who's now running the VB.NET team, language designer, once said in one of his presentations on language design, answering a question about why C-sharp doesn't have XML literals, Lucian said, "I have told Anders at least once recently that if C-sharp has implemented XML literals, this won't be a problem." The guy is now asking, Lucian didn't mention what this is in his talk, but I guess it could be the Razor parser. XML literals, Razor parser.
I mean,
do you understand where he's trying to go?
Yeah, I sort of see. I mean, one thing to say is this is not XML literals in C-sharp. The big thing being your markup has to be at the start of a statement. You can't go var foo equals some markup. You can't do that in the Razor parser as is.
Mm.
So we're not trying to add XML literals to the C-sharp language, and there's a lot of complicated issues for that, and it's really something for the C-sharp team to do because we don't want to write that kind of complex parser. We were able to take advantage of a lot of C-sharp's regularity in the way, you know, statements end with semicolons, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of those rules allow us to insert these implicit jumps back to markup
mm-hmm.
at the start of statements, but we're nowhere near the point of being able to do something like this. And we're not trying to be.
Sure.
We're not trying to do XML literals in C-sharp or HTML literals in C-sharp.
Which, you know, that's up to the C-sharp team.
Exactly, yeah.
Now, let me ask you a question. I mean, I read Scott Gu's blog, and he said we focused very hard to ensure that we weren't actually going to write another language.
Right.
But to me, this is a DSL.
Yeah, in many ways.
I mean,
it's a DSL
that uses
C-sharp as its code language. It's a little, I mean, sometimes when you hear talk about DSL, you talk about a language nested within a code language, like mm-hmm. using fluent interfaces in C-sharp, that kind of thing, to pretend to be like a DSL. Or Ruby has a lot of DSLs that are just method calls.
Mm-hmm.
In many ways, this is kind of backwards because the code language is nested within this.
Okay.
But it is, at its essence, a domain-specific language. It's just like ASPX is a domain-specific language for the web.
Yeah.
Razor is a domain-specific language for templating.
Cool. Now, in this world of, you mentioned you didn't do any code optimization, so there's no point in really talking about, parallelism and concurrency and how you can do that in your implementation of this list. So my assumption is that you're parsing through line by line, right? You are then taking the expressions, understanding what's code, what's not, and then going ahead and doing calls to some lists, in-memory lists, right?
Basically.
To figure out, is this, is this that?
Yeah.
Explain us a little bit more deeply how this is actually architected.
Yeah, so I mean,
you've already gone over it briefly.
Yeah, I mean, the big thing is like these lists, these keywords, right?
Yeah.
These keywords cause special behavior because basically if it's anything other than a keyword, then it's rendering out a value. But if it's a keyword, we do special stuff. So, I mean, the C-sharp parser just has within it a dictionary with key being the keyword, and the value is some helper delegate inside the parser that actually handles parsing that code.
Mm.
So one of the special interesting cases, for example, is using. Using has two purposes in C-sharp. It can be a block, where you put something that you want to be disposed when you get to the end, or it can be used to import namespaces. Right?
Yeah.
So one of the features of Razor is that you can write this at using system.something, and it'll just work. It'll know where to put it in the final generated code, and it'll make sure it gets placed in the right and put in the right place. One of the things is we didn't want to have a lot of directives like ASPX has. So ASPX has an import directive at the top of your page.
Totally.
Instead of doing that, we just said, well, let's use the code language. We'll just take this and pull it up to the right place. So, you know, there's in our dictionary inside the parser, there's an entry for using, and it has a method which says, okay, well, what's after it? Is it a parenthesis? Okay, well, then parse it like this. If it's not, then we know to parse it differently and to put it in a different place. I mean, it's basically just that's really the main sort of special casing we have to do. But yeah, I mean, it's just a dictionary in the.
It's actually really cool. I mean, I think I'm going to retract my statement about DSL a little bit because, and as you said, ASP.NET in some sense is more of a DSL than this because you actually brought in the whole language.
Right.
Which is nice that I could say, because I remember the open. You know, brace and then pound sign, pound import, pound whatever, pound
yeah,
whatever, pound
at
whatever.
Import was, yeah,
and then, you know, that was completely specific only to that weird little world I was
right.
in ASP.NET. Whereas this takes a C# developer, can get in here and just use the at sign, understand a little bit about HTML. It'll be interesting to see how this Razor thing fits in with the whole have the designer take care of the HTML junk. And then the developer actually make it work.
Yeah. In many ways, it fits best into the have the designer write the HTML, the static data. And then the developer goes in and sees a bulleted list with a bunch of entries. They say, okay, collapse it down to one, wrap it in one of these for eaches, and you're done, right? You know, because this code is in the markup text, if you open this up and say Dreamweaver, Expression Web, one of those tools, you're going to see it in the design surface because it's there in the markup. So it's maybe not quite as tuned to that sort of going the other way around. But it definitely works going the one direction, and it's certainly works pretty well going the other, too.
So. Cool. So let's talk a little bit about you're working on this. You get hired at Microsoft. You spend 9 months on this. Give me, you know, what was the most challenging part for you, and exactly what did you do?
Most challenging part. I think a lot of it was just working out that statement tracking system, because it turns out that it's not as simple as just find the semicolon. I mean, C# has a lot of things. First off, you have to make sure to detect strings and comments, because if you've got var foo equals quote semicolon, this is not the end of the statement. This is the end of the statement.
Yes.
That's fairly simple logic. Same with comments. You want to ignore those. So effectively, we have to build in a string and comment parser. The other thing is these ifs and these using blocks, they're statements, but they don't quite, like, they don't end here. Like, there's a statement is the whole thing, but we want to put markup inside it as well. So we need to be able to sort of recursively track these statements. And similarly, we got to be careful about, well, what if the user leaves off the semicolon? What do we do there, right? And the behavior in the current parser is we still got to try and find something to end the block. So we try to find something like this closed curly brace. So if you're inside here, you go var foo equals, and you leave off the semicolon, you're incomplete. And this is one of the things that we had to do a lot of work on is incomplete statements at runtime are errors, and they're going to throw a yellow screen, and it's not going to matter that much how we parsed it. But we're using the same parser at design time, and this is perfectly valid at design time as you're typing out that statement. You don't want your colorization to go all wonky because we've lost track of where you are. So we have to have a lot of recovery to say, oh, okay, well, we see this closed curly brace. That matches with this, so we'll just end here and we'll be good, right? It was sort of that error recovery and the edge cases around all of these that made it really difficult. And the fact that we're using this parser at both runtime and design time makes those cases extra complicated, because at runtime it's pretty easy. You see an error, throw. You're done, right? Then the user goes in and corrects it. At design time, because the parser is also driving colorization, we want to try and, if we see an error, we want the output to be as accurate as we can make it. I mean, we can't be perfect because there's an error. There's a syntax error somewhere, but we want to be as accurate as we can make it so that the colorization doesn't go all bonkers, basically. Yeah, that's the big one of the biggest challenges.
Interesting. Very cool. And I mean, if, for people who have been writing ASP.NET apps and have big ASP.NET apps out there with inline code from the traditional thing, there's nothing wrong with that. That's just another view control or another sort of view template.
Yeah.
Or templater, or templatizer, whatever you want to call
yeah,
it.
Yeah, templating engine.
Viewing engine, whatever.
Yeah.
So this is represents just a new way to approach things. It's not like, and it's definitely an evolution, but it's not, I mean, what win does it give you at execution time? This is a design time sort of thing. People need to, so here's what I'm trying to ask you. You have already in ASP.NET MVC, you can choose a couple different...
different view engines.
View engines, right? This becomes one of them in the future sometime.
Right.
So the question I want to ask is, whenever you give people choices, it's good to have a little reasoning behind why I would choose this versus the old model. I agree the old model had an extra few steps and the bumblebee thing.
It's still a good model.
Totally.
Yeah.
It's still going to be a choice.
Yeah, and I think the thing that Razor does is it brings code and markup together, and it's a bit more code-focused than some of the others. Because the other syntaxes. For example, Spark is one of the popular external third-party view engines, and that, instead of, it's sort of almost the reverse of Razor. Instead of putting the code around the markup, it puts the code in the markup. Mm. So you go li and you put an attribute on there that says repeat it for each item. So this brings the code to the forefront, and you're sort of showing the code, and then you put some markup within it. And that appeals to different different people, right? So a different audience. And that's sort of what Razor brings. It sort of brings the code in tight with the markup.
Cool.
In a sort of really close way.
That's a good thing. Now, finally, we've been talking only about C#, but
right.
I mean, I would imagine this is useful for, you know, you have VB HTML.
We do, yes.
New file extension. Now, as a developer, I may not use C# or VB.NET.
Right.
Maybe I'm using some other CLI compliant language.
Right.
What happens then?
Right. So I'm back to that sort of first diagram, box diagram I drew a little bit ago.
Okay.
We have the Razor sort of orchestrator parser, and then we have the HTML parser and the C# parser. Mm-hmm. Well, these are both actually general purpose. There's abstract base classes. There's a code parser and an HTML and a markup parser. So we've also got a VB parser.
Okay.
And so you can pick that pairing or that pairing.
Yep.
But there's no reason you couldn't write an F# parser, FSHTML.
Yep.
You can write that pairing if you want. You could write a Ruby parser.
Excellent.
Using Iron Ruby. RBHTML. We do sort of, like, our infrastructure relies a lot on the code DOM, which Ruby doesn't quite support, that Iron Ruby doesn't really support, but there are a lot of ways you can work around that. You could generate C# code that calls into the Iron Ruby engine, for example. Mm-hmm. But basically, the gist of it is that if you want to make your own code language, it's absolutely supported, and all the APIs are public, you can create your own code parser that implements from the base classes here, and then plug it into our build provider with an extension of your choosing, RBHTML, for example. And then you write a code generator, which then takes that parsed stuff and spits out code. Mm-hmm. It could be Ruby code. It could be C# code, even though you're parsing Ruby. That could be just fine. Mm-hmm. But the idea is that we wanted this to be very extensible from the code language side, because already in ASPX, anything that really supports code DOM mostly supports ASPX, right? And we wanted to try and mimic that a bit in Razor. And so we did that by abstracting this out so that there's that option to extend it with additional code languages.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, hey, I think we've gone pretty deep. I mean, unless you want to, like, really, like, rip this thing apart. I mean, I don't know how much farther we can go in.
I mean,
parser,
sure.
We've covered all the basic. I mean,
yeah, I mean, that's the basic how.
So why don't you just draw up sort of a little picture of how your parser actually works from a, like, so just for fun, you know, draw the picture of the sample that you just had written down there, and then map that into your execution steps.
Okay.
And then into specific pieces. And I like your Spock doll there,
yeah.
By the way. That's cool.
The Spock bobblehead.
Right on, man.
All right. I'm going to simplify the sample a little bit here.
Yes.
To make it easy. This is sort of one of the samples I was sort of working with a lot. So we assume we've got some collection products here. We're going to go over each item and render out in an LI the name of the product. Right. So we call into the main markup parser. There's literally a method, parse document. And so it is responsible for parsing this whole document. And so it goes through and it gathers up these, and it outputs some tokens to the result. And it will see this at sign, and it'll do... first thing it does when it sees the at sign is the email address check. One of the things that was mentioned on Scott Goo's blog is that you could still write an email address, right? Like anurse@microsoft.com.
Yep.
And it won't disappear. It won't, like, think this is code. It won't get confused. It'll say, that's an email address, so I know what it is. So it does this check, and it basically what it's doing is it's looking at these sort of two letters around the email address. And if they're both valid parts of an email address, we're going to assume it's an email address. If you don't want it to be an email address, you can use the parentheses and escape that.
Okay.
So that's the first thing that happens when it sees this at sign. And when it sees this at sign, so we were in the markup parser, it now calls into the code parser, which it has a reference to, and it says parse a block. And the code parser takes this keyword.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, first thing it does, it looks at the first character.
Sure.
If it's a curly brace, if it's a parenthesis, it knows what, it has some special logic there. But in this case, it's a keyword, so it reads that keyword, and then it looks it up in its table, and it ends up going into something like parse for each block. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And the for each block method knows that it goes to read this first, that's code, then it goes open curly brace. And now it knows to parse a block of statements. This is where that tracking is going on. Mm-hmm. So now we're saying we're inside the for each. So look at this statement. So if you had var foo equals and something with a semicolon, it would know to read over that and skip that. But in this case, it knows, it sees the first character of the statement is this open angle bracket. So it says that's markup.
Mm-hmm.
So now we call in back into the markup parser. We call parse block. So the markup parser is now parsing a block of markup. It reads, it sees that it's got an LI, it starts, sets up its stack ready to go, but then it sees another at sign, does its email address checking again, and it calls back into the code parser. So I've sort of nicknamed this process a sort of recursive tennis match.
Nice.
Because you've got code and markup, and they're going back and forth and back and forth and
sure.
back and forth. They're calling into each other recursively.
Mm-hmm.
So we end up with this long sort of recursive call stack. And basically, so here we see that, we know to parse a code block, it looks at that first identifier again, looks up in its table, it's not there. So it uses the logic I mentioned earlier to sort of grab as much of the expression as it can, and it figures out, okay, P, that's good, dot name, okay, that's still part of the expression, pulls it all in.
Mm-hmm.
Then it sees something else, this angle bracket, that's not part of the expression anymore. So now it returns. And now this is where we start coming back up the call stack. It returns. The markup parser reads this chunk, matches it up with what's on its stack, and knows the LI block is finished, so it returns. This returns. We see this curly brace. We know we're at the end of the for each, so these return, and then we see. And then the UL doesn't actually have any behavior because it's outside. There's no code around it, so we don't need to know when it ends. So this keeps going along, and then it gets to the end of the file, and we're done.
Mm.
And the parsers just say, we're finished. They output a little tree, basically, which says, you got markup here, then you've got code here, then you've got markup here, and you got code here.
Mm-hmm.
And then our code generator comes in, takes that tree, and builds a C# class, just like the ASPX parser does right now. And the code generator side is almost identical to ASPX, because it's really just, once you've got those spans, it's almost as if, you could almost translate it into ASPX.
Sure.
Because you just have to write the angle bracket percents. What our parser is really just doing is using more magic to figure out where those spans are.
Mm-hmm. Now, for this particular sample, I mean, if I wanted to play a little, you know, make recursion even more tennis, like Wimbledon finals,
yeah.
I could just do a for each around the ULs.
And then, like, ifs and for eaches,
and then
you could go as far as you
want.
Yeah. Yeah, and I talk about...
You'd really be playing tennis then.
Yeah, and we've tried, like, whenever we say recursion and we get into parsing, it's like, there's stack overflow issues, how big is it? And we've had our testers have been pumping in like files. They've got some generator tool that will take basically some HTML and they'll like wrap blocks around everything. They'll wrap code around the entire document and every little chunk of it. Awesome. Things that you would never really do in
release.
But that's the point. It's to stress the parser. And we've done a lot of work to make sure that the parser holds up to stress.
Perfect, man. And I know you have a blog.
Yes, I do.
So you're getting feedback from people.
Yeah.
And you'll be making more blog posts.
Yeah. I'll probably find this video on Channel 9 and I can keep it on in the comments.
So that would be great.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's really, keep up the great work, man. Thank you for letting us take the razor to this and kind of dig in a little bit.
I'm planning, I can post in the Channel 9 comments when it gets posted, but I'm planning some blog posts really going in depth into this too. So if you want to sort of get a look at the code and how it's working.
I really think that would be useful from the standpoint of, and it's sort of why I asked the last question to begin with, was for people who want to build their own parsers.
Yeah.
It's really great to see what you guys did when they want to implement for their own language.
Yeah. And the other thing is, I'm going to be looking at posting to my blog a console app that actually uses the Razor parser.
Nice.
And is completely separated from the ASP.NET pipeline. So it just takes this and generates a single class with a single execute method that renders it. There's no HTTP application to worry about. So that'll be a sample of sort of how to, you'll be able to take that and like tweak it, and then how to embed Razor into completely non-web related apps.
Very interesting. I could see a useful thing perhaps in, say, a Word document or some sort of Office document.
Yeah, there's all sorts of opportunities for that.
Very cool, man. Well, hey, thank you for your time.
Yeah, thanks.
Learned a lot today.
No problem.